Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue listening to Tom Kohler's reading of Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in two harbors. This book concludes this Friday. Next week, we will be starting a new book, longtime Two Harbors resident and teacher, Dennis Hirschbach's novel, A River Through Two Harbors. But now, we'll pick up where Tom left off yesterday with Whistling Pines.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 26. When I returned to my office after lunch, the phone was ringing, which elevated the dull ache in my head to a sharp pain. I scooped up the phone, as much to stop the noise as to answer the call. "This is Peter." "Peter, this is Pastor Hamlin." My mind searched quickly for a connection, and I looked at the caller ID for help, Two Harbors Luth. "Pastor, what can I do for you?" I said, just as I realized that the pastor was the person who was conducting Axel's funeral. Anxiety swept over me. "Actually, I think that I can help you," the pastor said lightly. "Our secretary has been swamped with people calling to get the details of Axel Olsen's funeral. She started counting yesterday and came to me when the tally surpassed the capacity of our sanctuary." "Oh, Lord," I whispered to myself. "That's exactly what I said, Peter, and the Lord answered my prayer. I spoke with my friend John Pine, the pastor at North Shore Lutheran Church on London Road in Duluth. They have a huge church that can easily accommodate the 300 to 400 people we think are coming. I took the liberty of asking him if we could move the funeral to his church, and he was delighted to be of help." 400 people, I said to myself. "I know, that's quite a turnout for a funeral. I'm not at all acquainted with Axel or his family, but he must have been quite a figure in the community for so many people wanting to remember him." "Oh, yes, Pastor Hamlin, he was quite a figure in the community." "Was he a war hero, too, Peter? Quite a few people have asked about the Bagpipe Honor Guard." I found myself at a loss for words. I can't really say." I had a sudden memory of the photo in the broken picture frame, Axel receiving a military decoration. Just as quickly, the picture changed to 400 disappointed people expecting a Bagpipe Honor Guard and instead getting Wendy playing Loch Lomond on the organ. Not to mention 400 people fighting over half enough food. "Is something wrong? I thought you'd be happy that I was able to find a bigger church." "Peter, I've already anticipated your problem. I have the Ladies' Aid Society coming in this afternoon. The ladies will call the family and all the people who've been making inquiries to let them know that we've moved the funeral to Duluth. I've even contacted the Duluth News Tribune, and they'll have a corrected obituary in tomorrow's newspaper." "Pastor," I said, at a loss for words. "Really, Peter, no thanks are necessary. I'm happy to be of service to you and the family. Just let me know if there's anything else I can do." I thought about asking him to find a piper, but decided that I shouldn't ask for any miracles beyond those that he was already providing. Instead, I just said, "Thanks." Wendy was standing behind me when I hung up the phone. "Are you okay? I heard that you got a nasty bump on the head." When I turned so that she could see the stained shirt and the darkening rings under my eyes, she recoiled. "Not only do you look bad, but the blood on your shirt is a little distressing. Do you have an extra shirt?" I looked at the front of my shirt and then at my reflection on the computer screen. This is becoming a bad day. "I read your horoscope. It said that Libras should stay home and pull the covers over their heads." I was having a hard time focusing, and Wendy drifted in and out of my focal distance. "Can you hold still?" "I'm not moving, Peter." "Oh, crap." Jenny showed up, also out of focus, and applied something that felt like it had come from the polar ice cap against my forehead. "If you refuse to go to the emergency room, this will, at least, minimize the swelling. if it doesn't give me a brain freeze, I said, trying to push her hand away, but I just didn't have the strength or resolve to fight her. You don't have to be a macho hero here, Peter, Jenny said, pressing the ice pack against my forehead. You, of all people, know you could use a couple stitches in that gash in your forehead. Instead, you'll have to let me put a couple butterfly closures on your forehead and then put up with the scar. I don't have time to go to the hospital. There's too much left to do before the funeral. Can we move on? I asked. The funeral is being moved and we've got work to do. When did that happen? Jenny asked as she opened a pack of sterile surgical butterflies and carefully applied several to my forehead. Pastor Hamlin called, and they're moving the funeral to a bigger church on London Road in Duluth. He's having the ladies' aid notify people of the change, and there will be a revised obituary in the paper tomorrow. Cool, Wendy blurted out. What? That's really cool. They have this giant pipe organ that's got like 10 octaves. I went to an organ recital for the university music department there. The organ is awesome, and the acoustics in the sanctuary are more awesome. I can hardly wait to get my hands on it. I'll have to go down early tomorrow morning to practice. I moaned. Wendy, you have to call Cousin Enos to let him know that he's driving the bus to Duluth instead of the Two Harbors Lutheran Church. How about the Canadian hooker? Len's voice came from around the corner. Shouldn't someone contact her and let her know about the change? Technically, she's got a phone sex site, so she's not a hooker, Wendy explained. Len tilted his head down and looked over the top of his glasses at Wendy. A phone sex operator wouldn't come to Minneapolis for a convention. She could take the calls in Winnipeg. She's coming to the Mall of America for the shopping. I think the convention came up as a sidelight in all our email correspondence. Guys, my head's about to break open, and the pain is killing me, I complained. Can you take your discussion outside? Peter, you started to tell me about Flory's theories about Axel's murderer, Len said, after Wendy left. I started to shake my head no before I realized that even a small motion caused me immense pain. She didn't tell me that. Maybe she doesn't know that she knows the motive, Len said. Huh? Flory knows about a whole bunch of Axel's dirty laundry, and she's been sharing pieces with you. She might have the piece that'll let us put the puzzle together. Len reached back and pulled the door shut. He patted his pockets until he found a lighter and lit the pipe as I watched silently. He inhaled deeply, closed his eyes, and then held his breath. An aura of satisfaction spread across his face. I didn't have the energy to stop him. She threw out like 10 things. How do we find out which one is the motive? Maybe she didn't tell you everything she knows, Len said as pipe smoke leaked from his mouth. She may have exposed the tip of the iceberg to you, but there could be more that she didn't mention. Something that Flory said hung in the back of my mind like it was hidden behind a black curtain. It suddenly popped to the surface. Flory said something about Axel traveling around in his Lincoln. Did you ever check his car to see if there's anything in it that might point to the killer? The BCA went over it with a fine-toothed comb. The agent who did the search said the outside looked like he'd been driving by Braille, but the inside was mostly clean, Len said. Driving by Braille? I asked. Every fender was dented like he'd been playing bumper cars, Len replied. I doubt that he could even see the corners of the fenders of that big old town car. The office door flew open, and Wendy stood there glaring at us. All right, this is not acceptable. You can't smoke in here. Besides, your pipe tobacco smells like you swept it off a barn floor. I tried to protest, but Wendy cut me short as Len searched for a place to dump his pipe. I don't care who was smoking, Peter. It's your office, and you shouldn't allow it. She stood with hands on hips, looking menacing for about 5 seconds, and then announced, I've got a load of little old ladies to take shopping. As quickly as she appeared, Wendy swept out of my office, leaving Len and me in the blue haze of smoke. "Doesn't anyone around here knock?" Len grumbled as he pulled out his chrome tool and snuffed the tobacco plug. He briefly looked at my overflowing wastebasket and decided not to dump the ashes there. "I suppose it's my own fault for not locking the door when I walked in." "Most people don't lock their rooms," I said. "Anyone can walk in, and most of the residents welcome the visitors." There wasn't any sign of forced entry to Axel's apartment, so the killer either walked in through the unlocked door or Axel let the killer in. "It might be time for change," Len replied. "At this point, it would be like closing the barn doors after the horses are out." "I prefer to think of it as getting smart and take heed of the warning," Len replied as he pulled the lighter out again. He put the lighter back in his pocket and clamped the pipe between his teeth. "Don't worry, I'm not going to light it." Wendy appeared at my door, her face flushed and slightly out of breath. "Could you give Jenny a hand? I just called the ambulance. We'll need some help getting Lloyd Borzek onto a gurney." It's hard to explain how a burst of adrenaline affects me, but my pain was on the back burner as the three of us quickly hustled to the stairs and ran to the second floor. "What happened to Gup?" Len asked. "Gup?" I asked. "Back in high school, Lloyd was the halfback for the football team," Len explained as he caught his breath. "He wasn't very good, and he fumbled at least once in every game. Someone said he was the opposite of Pug Lund, the famous All-American football player for the University of Minnesota, so everyone started calling him Gup. Pug, backwards." Len continued as we walked down the hall. "Gup was a muscular man who'd worked the railroad until a rail coupling mangled his right hand. That all happened before I was born, and my early memories of Gup were of him standing behind the counter in his butcher shop wearing a blood-stained apron. Every kid who went into the store would rush to the end of the counter where Gup stocked wieners. Gup called the kids little beggars, but would dole out a coarse-ground wiener to each one of us with a smile. I remember the wieners being tiny in his ham-sized left hand. He was probably the only one-handed butcher in Minnesota." Inside the apartment, Jenny was standing beside Gup, who was stretched out on his recliner. He looked pasty and was drenched in sweat. At first, I thought he was unconscious, but his eyes popped open when we approached his chair. "Hey, Len," Gup said, ignoring the rest of us. "I guess I must have had one too many meatballs." Saying those few words left him breathless. "Gup, I can still see you in the butcher shop making meatballs." For the benefit of the rest of us, Len made a circular motion over his stomach. Gup made the best meatballs. He'd grab big lumps of hamburger in his good hand and roll them on his bare stomach. A smile flickered on Gup's face. That gave them extra flavor. Jenny gave a furtive glance to Gup's barrel chest and rolled her eyes. I'd think the Board of Health would object to that technique. "Let me tell you, honey, my belly is a lot more sanitary than the meat scraps that go into most sausage." Gup took a sudden deep breath and arched his back. He writhed in pain and his face turned ashen. Behind me, Len called the dispatcher and asked if the ambulance was near. "Come on," Jenny said, "let's get him on the floor." The four of us struggled to get Gup out of his recliner and lying flat. Jenny pulled a blood pressure cuff out of her pocket and wrapped it around Gup's arm. His color got a little better when Wendy slipped a pillow under his feet, although he continued to take shallow breaths. "What do you think?" Gup asked Jenny. "Am I going to be on the same side of the sod as Axel?" Jenny, who is the most reassuring person I've ever known, was searching for the right words. Gup closed his eyes and nodded. "I thought it was that bad." He struggled to catch another breath as another wave of pain grabbed him. Beads of sweat glistened on his forehead, and he clutched his chest with his huge left hand. I was struck with the terrible thought that I'd have to plan funerals in 2 consecutive weeks. Gup relaxed, and I thought he'd breathed his last, but he drew in another breath. The whine of the ambulance siren was getting close, and I hoped they were close enough. Gup was taking rapid, shallow breaths, and his eyes didn't open again. Jenny took his blood pressure again, then took a second reading. She looked at Len and bit her bottom lip as I bolted to meet the EMTs at the front door. Thankfully, Gup had a little color and was breathing more easily when the EMTs wheeled him through the lobby. The hum of the voices in the lobby stopped when the gurney rolled past. The only sounds were the hiss of the oxygen mask over Gup's face and the squeaking of a gurney wheel that needed oil. Howard Johnson was standing next to me in our silent vigil. When the doors closed behind the EMTs, he took a deep breath. "I wish you'd have the ambulance come to the back door. I hate the regular reminders of my own mortality." Len walked up behind us as activity returned to the lobby. "Howard, I've been talking to the guys at the barber shop, and everyone has a story about Axel's murder. What do you know about Axel's gold mine?" I marveled at the value of Len's experience. I wouldn't have gone to the barber shop for information, but the two hubs of all city gossip were the barber shop and the beauty parlor. There wasn't a secret in Two Harbors that hadn't been passed at one of those venues. "Some stories never die," Howard said, shaking his head slowly. "Axel was running all over the region, buying up ugly, landlocked pieces of land at sheriff's auctions for bargain basement prices. The rumors were raging from the uranium speculation of the 80s to the paper pulp shortages of the 90s. Axel's land always seemed to lack an access easement, which made them useless for anything but helicopter logging. Axel told people that someday someone would find precious minerals, or diamonds, or uranium, and when they did, the state and county would certainly provide an easement so the minerals could be mined. In the meanwhile, he argued with the tax assessors about the valuation of swampy timberland without road access. "What about the gold?" I asked. "What about it?" Howard replied. "There are veins of minerals all over northern Minnesota. Hematite and taconite are in the Mesabi Range. Copper and nickel deposits are near the boundary waters. I suppose if a guy had enough parcels of land in a checkerboard around valuable mineral land, eventually you'd find yourself sitting on top of a vein of some mineral. My guess is that the mineral deposits you find most often around here are gravel that's salted with a few Lake Superior agates. Last I heard, agates were going for about $5 a pound." Howard paused, looking at my shirt. "Peter, if you don't have a spare shirt here, I'll loan you one. In the meanwhile, could you take your vomit-stained shirt away from the dining room?" I think I was so tired that I didn't even turn red. I nodded numbly. "I've got a Hawaiian shirt in the car that I used for our luau dinner. I'll put that on." The cold wind seemed almost cathartic as I stood next to the car and stripped off my once white shirt. A wolf whistle caught my attention. I spun around and saw Miriam walking Tucker behind my car. "Nice abs, Peter," she said. "If you worked out a little, you could have a nice six-pack." Tucker bumbled along happily, stopping next to me to shake his head, beating my shins with his flopping ears. My headache and fatigue prevented a witty retort. I fished the gaudy Hawaiian shirt out of my trunk and shook it twice in an unsuccessful attempt to get rid of the wrinkles. "I heard you knocked your noggin," Miriam said, guiding Tucker between the cars. She was about 5'3" and had an ageless look that made me think she could be a couple of years older than I was, or she could have been my mother's age. She looked up at the bandage that Jenny had taped over the butterflies on my forehead. While Miriam was lighthearted and lent an air of fun to the kitchen staff, she could also be matronly and compassionate. She touched the bridge of my nose lightly. "Honey, you're going to have a raccoon mask for a couple weeks." "It'll be a nice look for the funeral," I replied. "Don't get too worked up over Axel's funeral," she said. tugging at Tucker's leash in an attempt to stop him from rolling on a spot in the grass that had piqued his interest. He responded by standing upright and shaking his head, which caused his ears to flap. He wasn't worth the effort that you're putting out. That's right, you're not an Axl fan either. Axl was like my drug-dealing neighbor in the Nevada trailer court, she replied. No one cared if he were alive or dead. His passing was just the loss of a boil from the butt of humanity. Anything besides the groping incident that makes you say that? Nope, just a couple years of exposure to him, she said. He wasn't worth the worry that he caused, although he wanted people to think that he was. Tucker was sniffing at a few deer pellets that were strewn on the grass, and Miriam pulled him away before he could eat or roll on them. There is one good thing that's come out of Axel's death. What would that be? It's given the residents a fourth discussion topic, she said. Tucker loped over to my tire and peed. What are the other three topics? Well, grandchildren are probably first, followed by the food. Wait, let me guess. The weather is topic three. Peter, don't you ever listen when you walk through the dining room? Sure, I hear people talking about the food and grandkids, so what's number three? Bowel movements. You're kidding. Nope, you go full circle and you worry about the basics, like poop. Are you Tucker's new parent? I asked, seizing an opportunity to move on to another subject. She shrugged. I'm not sure yet. He's okay most of the time. Do you have any idea what kind of mix he is? I mean, he's got the short legs and long ears of a basset, but his hair is too long and the color isn't right. Axel said he was Basset Hound and St. Bernard. The right corner of her mouth curled just enough to hint at a smile. You're joking. Axel said he was a tribute to the triumph of the little guy over the big guy. I've got to tell you, Peter, in all my years of farming, I've never seen animals with that much size difference breed. There's a whole lot of anatomy and physics that says that's not possible. I could buy a Basset and Beagle, but not the St. Bernard. Maybe if the dad had a little stool. Peter, you are such a city kid. Tucker still needs a home, regardless of his lineage, I said, quickly turning the conversation before it went in another direction that might violate some workplace rule. I'm not sure that I'm ready for an additional long-term commitment. The farm, a husband, and this job are enough for you? Miriam's eyes crinkled as she smiled, making me think she might be closer to 40. If only you knew. She patted me on the arm and walked away with Tucker, loping along happily at her side. My office phone was ringing when I returned. Caller ID said that it was a northern Minnesota cell phone. I picked it up, not anticipating the hornet's nest I was about to step into. Peter, this is going to cost you big, Wendy seethed. Settle down and tell me what's going on. It took me a second to remember that she'd taken a van load of residents on a shopping trip to Miller Hill Mall in Duluth. We're in the van, sitting in front of the mall, and I have two missing little old ladies. It's 20 minutes past the time we agreed to meet, and they're nowhere in sight. Did you contact mall security? Not yet, Wendy replied, a little of the gale force winds coming out of her sails. Go to the security office. Tell them who is missing and give them a description. Call me back in 10 minutes. I hate you, she said as the line went dead. My impatient 10-minute wait ended. I grabbed the phone on the first ring. Wendy, did you find them? Security did. They were sitting in a corner booth in the burger place, and they lost track of time after their third chocolate martinis. They were drinking? Hey, they're drunk. I got the security guys to help me pour them into their seats, and they're now happily snoring. I don't know exactly what this is going to cost you, but it'll be big. Settle down, I said, before I realized that I was talking to a dial tone.
You've been listening to episode 13 of Whistling Pines by Dean Hovey. This book will conclude this Friday, April 16th. As usual, the week's episodes will be posted on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab at the end of this week. Next week, we will begin Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors, published by North Star Press of St. Cloud in 2014. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. The book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. It will run for about 4 weeks through mid-May. Dennis Hirschbach was a longtime Two Harbors resident and teacher, now living in southern Minnesota. To quote his Facebook page, Dennis is an award-winning author and poet whose writing is heavily influenced by the joys and sorrows of the human condition. Be sure to tune in the next 2 days at 1 p.m. for the conclusion of Whistling Pines.